Welcome to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. I'm your host, Christina Frazier. In this week's conversation, Dr. Robin Stevenson, professor of urban studies and urban planning at the University of Florida, talks about white supremacy, but not the kind with bedsheet swastikas or burning crosses. Dr. Stevenson explains how white supremacy became ingrained in our most familiar institutions, city governments, financial institutions, schools, law enforcement, and others, because the men who founded those institutions shared the false belief that white Americans were superior to other groups. Dr. Stevenson exposes several common white privileges many people take for granted or don't even recognize, and offers suggestions on how to put an end to an unwitting supremacy that most white Americans don't believe in. This show is recorded at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church here in Kansas City, Missouri. Our show's format begins with our speaker's presentation, followed by a short break, and then concludes with the question and answer part of the program. Thanks for tuning in. Now let's join the conversation here at 90.1 FM, KKFI.
I'm Bill Mullins. Welcome to the forum at All Souls. The forum exists to afford a platform for the discussion of significant issues, especially those that involve ethical values in the contemporary world. And I think that today we're continuing in a series of particularly timely presentations and conversations. Dr. Robin Stevenson is someone I've known for 4 or 5 years now. We got involved back in the days when Dr. Covington was involved with the Kansas City Public Schools and have crossed paths off and on. She was a professor at UMKC for a number of years and is now at the University of Central Florida. She's an avid, active worker in community rights, and unlike the normal practice today, Robin is going to be functioning in a little more interactive fashion, so there will be opportunities for you to raise your hand and vote from time to time, or perhaps provide some feedback. We will run probably a little longer in terms of the normal time, but leave some time for questions, and Robin will be able to spend some time with us after the regular session in the library for those who have questions to ask, and we don't get time to do that. So I think I've covered everything. Without any further ado, here's our speaker.
Thanks, Bill. Appreciate it. So good morning. Thank you for having me today. I absolutely appreciate being back in Kansas City and being in such a loving and comfortable space as the All Souls Church. I've spent a few times here engaging in the forum, not as speaker, but as listener, and I know this congregation to be very supportive and very intuitive and listening, so I feel very comfortable being here today. So as I was preparing for this talk this morning, I was reading a lot of articles and reading Tim Wise and reading Ta-Nehisi Coates, and I do what I do as a professor. I study things and I think about them, and I try to prepare logical arguments and important information. And as Bill said, I'm currently a professor at the University of Central Florida. I also taught at Rutgers in Camden, New Jersey. I also was a professor here at University of Missouri at Kansas City, UMKC. And I also taught at Florida Atlantic University, which is down in South Florida. And I'm here to talk with you today, not so much as a professor, but as someone who has a real concern about race relations and how we deal with that in our country. And I believe that change comes from discovery. So I want to take us on a little journey of discovery today. Racism and disparity and inequities are things that I have looked at and thought about my entire life. And as a woman, I've actually experienced some of that. And just to give you a little background on me, I grew up in a place called Cicero, Illinois, just outside of Chicago, which in the 1950s and 60s, was a place where if black families wanted to move in, they were met with firebombs and angry working class white people. I went to the University of Florida, where Buck O'Neill was denied admission because he was black. I lived in Camden, New Jersey, which is on the other side of the river, the Delaware River, from Philadelphia, but is a world away. It's 90% African American. It's one of the poorest cities in the country. It has the most crime for a city its size. And in Kansas City, I lived a block off of Lynnwood and Prospect. So I've seen and I've been in these places, but I'm white, so I've not experienced it. Okay. So I'm here with you to examine how it is that you and I have come to be white supremacists. Now that is provocative to say. It's like, well, I'm not a white supremacist. But bear with me, because we're going to walk through this and see what might be there for you. Okay? So I want you to think about that I'm not here to make anybody wrong. This is not about good or bad or right or wrong. It's just about thinking about and discovering. And an honest appraisal of where we are and whether or not we're going to continue on the path that currently exists. All right, so in a couple of weeks, you all are going to engage in the KC Nostalgia Festival, known as Lighting the Plaza. And you may have participated in this since you were a little kid, or maybe you recently come to this, but it's something that all Kansas Cityans enjoy. And I know when I first came to Kansas City, I was like, what? Light up the plaza? What? And it was like, oh, I quickly understood that this was something sentimental, nostalgic, and made everyone feel great pride in the city. And I want you to think about, as you enjoy the lighting of the plaza, is that it's about the way we wish things were, not necessarily the way things really were. And the plaza began as the first outdoor auto mall. Many of you know the history of it. And its development, its fountains, its architecture, these are all recognized and remarked upon and attributed to the prolific developer J.C. Nichols. And he gave people a sense of pride in Kansas City, and who doesn't love the plaza, right? And Nichols developed the plaza and a great deal of residential development around the city and in Johnson County. And how many of you have ever lived in a J.C. Nichols development? Yeah. Okay. All right. And how many of you have seen your property value come back since 2008, the recession? Or believe that it's a good investment in value to live in one of these houses? Yeah, of course. And how many of you live in an integrated neighborhood? Okay. And how do you know that it's integrated? How do you know the neighborhood is integrated?
Person next door is of a different race. People on the other side are of a different economic strata.
Okay, so economically integrated and racially or ethnically integrated. And we can visually see this or have some other markers that tell us that this is so. Okay? All right, so Nichols was successful because he had a foolproof marketing campaign. And that marketing campaign of his properties was that they were exclusive. Okay? Only whites could live in them by virtue of discrimination during the sales process. And he then propagated this through what I would call an insidious system of deed restrictions and homeowners associations that required the very people who bought those houses to then discriminate upon the sale of those houses. They could only sell to white people. So the exclusivity was codified, and it sold houses. Okay? So nobody's making him wrong. It worked, and that's what he was in business to do. So think about the economic value that you see in the plaza, in this church, in your neighborhood. Where do you think that economic value comes from? Okay. Where does the economic value come from in your neighborhood, in the plaza, in this church? History. What else? What else makes the property valuable?
Location.
Yeah, location.
Location, location.
Location, 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 yeah. And it could be that the property is well kept, it looks nice. Maybe crime rates are acceptable or even low. Yards are tidy. There's a variety of things that we see, and we say, oh, this is what makes the neighborhood valuable. This is what makes the neighborhood nice. Now, let me ask you this. Has anyone here ever been turned down for a loan? Okay, a few people. But for the most part, you probably have not experienced this. Has a realtor ever told you that he couldn't show you a home in a certain neighborhood? And have you ever had a realtor refuse to consider selling your home? Now, if you've sold your home since the recession, did you sell it to someone who didn't look like you? Hearing none, I will continue. So I had a house in Brookside, and I owned it for a couple of years, and I sold it for $20,000 more than I bought it for. And this was before the recession, so hoo-hoo, I made money on it. And then I bought a house in Ivanhoe. And it didn't cost very much. And I couldn't get a loan for it because the value was too low. I couldn't get an insurance policy on it because no one would write one. I recently put it on the market for sale by owner, and I put it on Zillow, and I had a realtor contact me. And when I told him where the house was, he says, oh, we don't sell houses in that part of Kansas City. I can't list it. Well, and I recently sold it for less money than I bought it for. And that's the tale of two cities that's built on exclusivity. Okay, so there's a systematic discrimination in real estate. And I've just given you the historical example here in Kansas City. But it also applies to school boundaries, city council districts, banks and real estate companies, redlining. Though people will say none of this exists legal anymore, it does exist in practice, and we know that. Okay. Studies have shown consistently since the 1960s that when you look at who gets a mortgage, even when you account for income, education, and credit score, African Americans are denied mortgages at rates higher than whites, and they're charged higher interest than whites. This is the vestiges of systematic discrimination in the real estate market. Now, the census clearly shows us that poverty is disproportionate to the size of the African American population. And it's concentrated in neighborhoods that are majority-minority. Poverty is generally an injustice that is perpetrated by white supremacy that comes out of that systematic discrimination. Now, our economic gain, people that look like me, and if you look like me, then you're included in the hour. Our economic gain is built on white supremacy, and it doesn't matter if you live in a Nichols home or not. If you're white in Kansas City, you benefit financially in real estate by being able to buy anywhere in the city and in places that were artificially inflated in value because of their white exclusivity. Now, what are you getting so far from this? I want to make sure that we're kind of on the same page. And I would normally say, turn to your neighbor and tell them what you're getting, but I see so many people sitting singly that you'd be talking to yourself. And you're all so far separated that you can't talk to each other. So would anybody like to volunteer? What are you getting so far? What are you hearing in this? Yes, sir. Yeah, so there's historic issues of profitability in real estate and discrimination. What else? Yes, ma'am. Yeah, so I get a personal benefit from this. Whether I like it or not, it's there. Okay? Anybody else? Yes, ma'am. Yes, ending the cycle is very hard. Okay? All right, well, thanks. Great. So how is it that Nichols made his exclusive real estate scheme work so well? Well, we don't have to really look any farther than the vestiges of slavery. And I want to talk about slavery as an institutional process because it's made up of laws and constitutional amendments. That's how slavery was systematized. And as an institution, not just a practice, it becomes a series of legal instruments that created it and now prohibits it. So the only thing that's standing between slavery and not slavery is the enforcement of laws. Jim Crow showed us that. We can introduce new laws that are discriminatory. We can introduce new laws that prohibit people to vote or make it harder for them to get an identification or to not vote at all if they are a prisoner or a convicted felon, I should say. So the only thing that stands between us and a free society for everyone is laws and institutions and the Constitution. So think about it in this way. The only thing that stands between African Americans and freedom is the enforcement of laws. And those laws could be taken away at any time. Now, you and I don't ever experience that kind of fear or worry or concern. But other people do, because it has happened. And it happens now in other ways. And we have things like sentencing discrimination and discrimination in the criminal justice system and in all kinds of other institutions. It's not codified as such, but it happens, right? So how many of you have ever been stopped for a traffic violation? Just raise your hands. Okay, keep them raised, yep. How many of you have gotten a ticket while stopped? Yep, keep them raised. How many of you feared for your life when you were stopped? Yeah, few, okay? It just is not the way that we experience the world. And the enforcement and the rules that are set up to fit the life of white people. It's a great system. We set it up for ourselves. It works for us. And it's a derivative of slavery. And even more insidious is the allowance that we give ourselves as white people, that it's natural for people to want to either live by themselves, live with their own kind, be in their own spaces, or that they should be obeying the police commands. It's a very common perspective for us to have. Now, we tell ourselves that this may not be discrimination. It's just how people are. And it's a personal preference of behavior that causes trouble, and it's a refined version of Nichols' exclusivity to justify discrimination. And it's not because you hate black people. I don't think you're racist, not at all. But it's really worse than that, because if you actually did hate black people, I could accept that, because it's your choice. What I'm talking about is that if you claim not to be a racist and you're willing to profit from the vestiges of slavery, then you're participating in modern-day discrimination. And that makes you a white supremacist. Now, what is white supremacy? Let's try to break this down. Is it people in polos and khakis that carry tiki torches? And they're shouting blood and soil, as we saw in Charlottesville, Virginia, not too long ago. Maybe it's motorcycle rednecks that beat up black people. They're certainly white supremacists. Maybe it's people in white pointy hoods. Or maybe it's people that wear Nazi swastikas. Surely they are racists and white nationalists, bigots and separatists. But white supremacy is the systemic power that maintains inequity, and it favors whites at the expense of all non-whites. And it protects you and me from discrimination. It protects us. So let's break this down. Systemic, and I'm sorry, but I'm a professor, so I have to give you a little bit of lesson, right? Systemic is a system that is embedded in laws and institutions. Power is the ability of me to make you do something that you otherwise would not do. And power is used to maintain the system. And inequity is the imbalance of value, treatment, disparity of outcome, based on qualities that have no bearing on that disparity. For instance, color of skin. There's no reason that someone should not be able to buy a house except for the color of their skin, which we make up. And that's an inequity, okay? White supremacist, white, skin and features, and it's a social construct. And it's based on physical features, which could just as easily be eye color, hair color, or foot size. Supreme is the top. It's better than the rest, built on separation that exalts one above the other. Ist is a person that claims these characteristics through belief, word, and or actions. Okay? So, how many people here have ever been discriminated against because they're white? Okay, so what did that look like for you? In the back. Yeah, so because of their religion and their origin, they were denied the sale to purchase the house, okay? Who else that's white has experienced discrimination based on race? Yes, sir. Yeah. Okay, so what he said is that he went to a restaurant on Troost and he perceived that he was treated badly because of his skin color, okay? And we want to be able to distinguish between perceptions and reality, and we want to be able to distinguish between discrimination based on race versus discrimination based on some other characteristic, like religion or origin. All right, so a recently released national study showed that more than half of white American respondents, 55%, believe that they or people like them suffer from racial discrimination. So this is a real opinion that's held by white people. Black respondents in the same survey, 92% felt that they had suffered from discrimination. Now, these are not groundbreaking results. We probably could have predicted this. African Americans also said that those African Americans that lived in suburbs were more likely to report experiencing violence than those in urban settings. And they don't feel safe living in that part of their community. You don't have to yell the N-word to be a white supremacist. You can benefit from the systems in place and their legacy and be carrying forward white supremacy. In other words, you can be a good liberal and an ally and still be part of the white supremacy world. Now, white privilege plus default white is what gives us white supremacy. And I want to draw a distinction between white privilege and white supremacy. And white privilege is the subtle benefits that we as white people are granted, often without our knowledge. And it's based on the notion that white is the societal default. An easy example is the color flesh tone or nude. Typically, it looks like my skin. But we all know that there are lots of other skin tones and nude colors. But they're not represented because white is the default. Now, whiteness is the dominant response, and it's the default in our standard operating system, in politics, in television, in movies, in our neighborhoods. I was once asked if I lived in an integrated neighborhood, and I said, well, yes, I do. And this is before I moved to Linwood and Prospect. And I said, well, yes, I do. And it was an African-American friend that was asking me, and he said, well, how do you know it's integrated? And I said, well, because I can see that there are several black people that live on the block. He says, if you can count them, then it's not really an integrated neighborhood. And what I realized is I had interpreted the question a little differently. To me, integrated was any black person living on my block. That meant it was integrated, okay? Now, the introduction of black Santas and black dolls made some white people uncomfortable. It's like, oh, that's not what I know. Why do we have to have a black Santa? Why do we have to have a black doll? Especially in a store I shop in. Shouldn't that be over in the other stores? Let them have a black Santa. A black anything is considered a token or thinly veiled as not fair or unearned. Default sets up an expectation that we get to live into. People of color constantly have to swim in whiteness. It can't be escaped. When they bump up against it, they find a workaround, which in their communities are common behaviors or actions or approaches to everyday living that our default forces them to undertake. Now, if they make us mad and they carry a badge, it could end badly. And if they talk back to this, they might lose their job. And if their kid acts out in school, they may end up in the criminal justice system. And this is not how we experience life. Because the color of our skin does not produce a response. Theirs does. Now think about this, and I had never even thought about this until I started investigating. There's a move afoot to boycott the NFL because some people are kneeling during the national anthem and some owners are upset about this, and I'm not going to watch the NFL. And is this an issue of racial injustice, or are you more concerned about patriotism and respect for the flag? And it's been made an issue of patriotism and supporting our troops and the flag. And there's an underlying issue to consider that you may not even be aware of. Can you be black and patriotic? Data suggests that for most whites, the two cannot coexist. There's a study that was done and reported on, and it said, when you hear about someone being patriotic, do you think of a white man, a white woman, a black man, or a black woman? And the results showed that the public's image of the prototypical American patriot is far more likely to be white than black. Only 28% of whites responded thought that the word patriotic describes most blacks very or extremely well, compared to 51% that thought that most whites are patriots. That's just our default. That is just our whiteness. And we wonder why we have separation and division. It's because we carry this with us constantly, as if this is the way the world really is. And it's just something we've made up. Let's just do a little hand raising. I was going to do stand up, but we'll just do hand raising this morning. So if you've ever been followed in a store, suspected of being a shoplifter, raise your hand. Thank you. If you are afraid for your life when you're stopped by the police, please raise your hand. You're more afraid of a ticket. I got it. Okay. If you've had a talk with your white identifying children about how to respond to a police stop, raise your hand. And if you understand that racial discrimination in housing, lending, jobs, and education exists, raise your hand. And if you understand that there is a racial divide in Kansas City, please raise your hand. So you see the difference. We all know about it, but most of us don't experience it. And knowing makes no difference. It doesn't change anything. It's just like, oh, well, there it is. So every person who identifies as white and raised their hand is benefiting from white supremacy. And if you're white and you didn't raise your hand, then you're probably just fooling yourself. The system works for us. And we are white supremacists by virtue of the system we perpetuate that values our skin color and features over those who don't look like us. Now, where do we go from here? Because we can sit and talk about this and wring our hands all day. And I'm sure many of you have engaged in these kinds of conversations before. But really, when you look at it, we really have to think about, well, what do we do about it? Someone said earlier, well, this is very difficult to make a change. Yeah, you bet it is. And you might be thinking right now, well, perhaps this is not the world I want, so let's change it. And perhaps you're sitting there thinking, well, this is not me, and I really don't accept this. Or perhaps you're thinking, this is really depressing or stupid, and I wish I hadn't come this morning. But wherever you are, it's okay, right? The good news here is that we control how this goes. We created it and we can change it. And the question, of course, is do you really want to? Because it means giving up something that you now enjoy. That's why it's difficult. That's why it's difficult to make a change. because we would actually have to give up something. And we may not really want to. Now, we have to take actions in order for there to be change. So what actions could we change or could we take to change the system or to change ourselves? I want you to think on that for a minute. Because really what this is about is what would you have to give up that you have now in order to change systemic power that maintains inequality? And I'd like to get some answers here. What would you be willing to give up? What do you think has to change that we can change in order for the system to change? I believe there's a gentleman there.
Distribution of wealth.
Okay, so distribution of wealth. But how is that going to work? Are you willing to give your money away?
I could after my student loans are paid.
That's a yeah, but. Thank you, though. Anybody else? What can we do to make some... We've got a lady in the front here as well. What can we do to make things change that we give up or we change about ourselves?
I don't really know how integrated our schools are, but if there's anything that can be done about that, which seems almost impossible, I think that would help if you start when kids are young.
And do you have any school-age children?
Yes. No, I don't. Not
okay.
At this time.
School-age grandchildren?
Yes.
Okay. And do they go to an integrated school?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So that's something that can be done.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
We can do more of it.
Yeah. We all need to do it personally.
And there was a lady up here in the front. I don't know if there's... Maybe we can grab the one in the back, and then we'll grab you in the front. Okay. This back. Well, apparently you're next.
I feel very strongly that intermarriage is partly a solution, and I don't know what are there any figures, whether this has increased. I know in my my family, nations in intermarriage has made a tremendous difference, with one member who had some African American Hispanic blood from back when the Spanish invaders down there were conquering, and you just don't think about it, and this, you know, she has a darker skin, somewhat darker skin than most Peruvians, so I don't know if there are any statistics.
Yeah, so we can be more tolerant or accepting of interracial marriage or interethnic marriage and relationships rather than being disapproving of them. Okay? Yes, ma'am.
In whatever way you can, crossing cultural lines, kind of shedding your comfort zone, making friends with people that, you know, just talking to somebody at your work, or and then being invited. I'm often invited to, you know, experience a part of their life, and just familiarizing our young ones with that as well.
Yeah. Actually having a conversation with people that don't look like you, that could be a huge game changer. Having people over to dinner, going out to lunch, just having a conversation can make a world of difference. Because typically people as white people hang around with white people. And without those conversations and exposure, we have no idea how other people see life. Yes, ma'am.
I have more space in my house in a neighborhood where I can count the non-whites, which means it's not really integrated. I have more space than I really need. I could take in Somalian refugees.
Yes, you could.
I could.
We could allow more affordable housing in neighborhoods that would allow for more of the existing poverty to coexist in other neighborhoods, introducing people to other income brackets, other races, other ethnicities. And that would take a lot on our part, because people worry about their property values, and they worry about crime, and they worry about a lot of things. And some of that is perception, and some of it is real. But it is something we could do. Yes, ma'am.
Pay higher taxes so that schools throughout the city are well-funded, and that so that the infrastructure in all areas are taken care of.
Yeah, we could have more money for schools and infrastructure in the entire community, and we could change the way that some of our services are delivered in some parts of our communities. Services are very unequal across Kansas City, and they're unequal because the outcomes are quite unequal. We could demand a change in the way public services are delivered and say, you know what, we want neighborhoods in this part of town to be just as beautiful and tidy as my neighborhood. And that's going to take something. It's going to take some public service. It's going to take some public attention. It's going to take some education. It's going to take some volunteering. And I'm willing to give up something to make that happen. Someone else has a question. Yes, sir.
I was just going to say, you know, I think one thing that people can do is when you see things happen, when you see disparities, to stand up and say something about it and call it out and try to correct it, because the people who are getting sometimes in the minority position don't feel comfortable standing up.
Yeah. White people can see something and say something. Now, sometimes that can be a dangerous thing, and sometimes it can be an unwanted thing. So you have to be somewhat in tune to what's going on. But yeah, you see discrimination happening in your workplace, in a store, in your church, in your hairdresser shop, in the Kohl's department store. Say something. You might have something to lose, but you could make a difference. Yes, ma'am.
As a parent of young children, one thing that I advise other parents to do, my children are multiracial, but I advise everybody to do, is have books and watch shows and have the cultural conversations that do not center whiteness, that make whiteness not a default, that the default is human. And then there, you can discuss the variations, what people look like, ability-wise, languages spoken. It's another difference, and it's real, and having the hard discussions when they are of a certain age, or even at younger ages, that, you know, people with darker skin sometimes are not treated the same in our culture, in our society. But just being willing, like you were saying, say something. Have those discussions.
Yeah,
it's the elephant in the room. Everybody knows it's there.
Right.
We can talk about it with our kids.
And that could be something as simple as be curious. Be curious. What are black traditions? What are Hispanic traditions? How do African Americans feel about this? You won't be educated unless you ask, unless you are curious. And maybe that means you read up on it. Or maybe it means you talk to other friends about it. Imagine having a conversation with other white friends where you say, you know what, I read this and I'm just shocked. I'm going to have that conversation with my friends I know about this, who's a patriot. I would never have even thought about that. But, you know, I thought about it in my mind's eye. And I thought, well, who? When I think of a patriot, who do I think of? And sure enough, yeah, it was a white person. I was like, oh, no. Really? What? That's just whiteness. But have that conversation. Imagine if we all had a conversation like that and were curious and said, wow, I just didn't even know that. Maybe we can make a change in that. Maybe that won't be the default that we think, or maybe the race of the person won't make a difference. That would be different. Yes, sir.
I think if we're going to be serious and really try and focus on discrimination, we need to separate economic discrimination from racial discrimination. We don't need to make assumptions that people of lower economic, what used to be called socioeconomic status in the literature, are axiomatically of another race. There is discrimination based on economic levels, and that will continue, and that can either be with racial overtones or it can be race neutral. And that has a set of solutions that one could work toward. At the same time, there is racial discrimination without regard to economic level, and that has a fairly different way to be solved. Some of the examples you've used mix those two. Yes, there was discrimination by law in J.C. Nichols' properties. They may today remain majority white, but some portion of that is probably the fact that the number of people of all colors who can afford a $700,000 house are fairly small, and yes, the number of African Americans is smaller still. And that's economic, not racial necessarily.
Yeah, and I won't step over this because economic poverty arises out of racial discrimination. So we can't always separate the two. But your point is well taken in that we do have discrimination of non-white folks, both who are poor and not poor, as well as poverty being in the midst of that. So I just want to leave you with the notion that, you know, we can make a difference, we can change things, but it is up to us to make that change, and it is up to us to realize that we may have to give up something, and that's okay, because where we are is somewhat ill-gotten. So thank you very much for having me today. I appreciate it.
I think we really only have time for one question. And I'll let Jeff be the honorary do the duties.
I'm going to try really hard to make this into a question. I live in the Quality Hill neighborhood of downtown, and I feel that unless we influence our government officials at the city level to not blindly endorse rapacious development in relation to building new condos and apartments which have extremely high rent, and also the byproduct of that being that rents go up substantially and people of color as well as poor white people can't afford to live in the areas that they were previously living in. So I wondered if you could comment on that and either refute that or endorse it in terms of something that we need to take action on.
So what I would say is please don't use your anti-growth sentiment as a trade for I'm supporting poor neighborhoods. Make the demand that poor people can't afford rents. Make the demand that neighborhoods should have opportunity for integration. Growth and development that is out of control and luxury in its orientation, yeah, that has a consequence. And it may not be the way we want our tax dollars to be spent in terms of incentives and tax support. And that's great. But don't use that as a way to say, and, oh, yeah, that'll help poor people and black people. Be a demand for that change as easily as you are demand for stop the luxury growth. That would be my response.
And this is the point where we present our honorarium.
Wow, thank you. Thank you. I will treasure this. Thank you.
announce the forum for next week. Louis Duguid will be here talking about his new novel. His biography, growing up in St. Louis in the life of his father, who was a black entrepreneur at a time when that was an extremely rare phenomenon, entitled Our Fathers Making Black Men. And I've heard this presentation. It's well worth listening and very much a continuation of the conversation we've had this morning.
Thanks for listening. I hope you've enjoyed tonight's presentation, Am I a White Supremacist? By Dr. Robin Stevenson. This program was recorded on Sunday, November 11th at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church here in Kansas City, Missouri. All Souls Forum is edited and produced for broadcast by Christina Frazier. Our theme song was composed, performed, and recorded by musician Fred Potter. This program will be available for podcast within 10 days of broadcast on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. Remember, you can also find archived All Souls podcasts and many other interesting and enlightening public affairs programs produced by KKFI on the KKFI website. Thanks for joining us this evening, and we hope you tune in next week, same time, same place, when we will continue the conversation here at 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City's community radio station.